So I guess with that, we're ready to start our day. Our first keynote speaker is John Burris.
Hi.
Good morning. So I changed the talk a little bit from based on yesterday's discussion. So first I'll give you about 5 slides of some directions we follow, and I think they are very promising. So the first 2 are on the general question of level of science. It's going to be relevant to the next panel. That's why I put it here. So I usually ask the question, what is the level of you? And in general, whether it's biology, economics, communications, whatever. And my answer is that why we have networks is because nodes or agents or whatever you want to call them, they want to collaborate because they benefit from the collaboration. They can do things from the collaboration that they cannot do alone. This is even true for utility power utility networks. You cannot go from here to New York without having several hops for power techniques. Okay, so you have benefit from collaboration, but the benefit of collaboration does not come free. There's cost. So if you want to collaborate for control, you have the cost of communication. If you want to communicate, you get the cost of energy. So, but the key discriminator from the work we're doing from a lot of work on games in networks is that we're actually using cooperative games, not competitive games. But they're cooperative games with constraints. The constraints come from the communications or other costs. This notion we run into when we do work on trust is very common in economics and sociology. The fellow actually who started this theory, Madison, got the Nobel Prize in Economics this year. So there's some pretty serious stuff, but we actually have mathematics, especially in the dynamic case, that the economists and sociologists have not done so. So many questions in networks come down to this fundamental trade-off, understanding the gains versus the cost of collaboration. And unfortunately, these words, gain and cost, are usually vector variables, not scalar variables. So it's a difficult trade-off problem. But you can, and I have many examples that I won't go over, trace many problems in networks of all kinds with this fundamental problem. And they are particularly important when networks have autonomy. They want to self-organize, do things on their own. This is kind of still important. In sociology, if you go to books and economics, you will find the subject really under the topic of network formation, how networks form. So we have several papers on this. I'll give you some graphs. Based on this cost versus benefits, for instance, communication networks, if you have a cost that is how many bits per second every node contributes to the common capacity versus the cost of something like energy, depending on the relative trade-off between cost and benefits, cost and power, let's say, if the cost is very low, links form, and the network becomes very well connected. If there is imbalance or sparsity, then the links form more gaps. If the cost is too high, they don't make a connected node, they get free. So this reminds you of percolation theory, right? But this is more powerful than percolation theory, A, because it's not asymptotic, it can do finite time results, and B, you have 2 variables to play, gain versus cost. You can actually recover percolation theory if you take the random percolation theory, the random connection model, and then the ratio of the benefit versus cost, and you randomize it becomes exactly the model. That's what we're discussing in particular. There's also phase transition phenomena on this. So if you look at this graph, you want to be down here where you have, this is number of coalitions versus, you know, V here is the bits per second that in a very simple model we have. And down here it says you have one component which means everybody well connected, they work together. If you go up here, right, you have many coalitions, so the level is not very correct. And then we have an exact theorem that tells you how the coalition happens. This is the beginning. Okay? There are many other things you can do. But you can formulate collaborative communications, like people are studying in this framework, and it gives you much tighter results than, for instance, you get by any method that I met right now. And one major application we're using, in addition to wireless networks, is we're using it to study social networks on the web, like people like Digin, eBay, and all this kind of stuff. So that's one topic that we work a lot on. Second, and I think it's very promising. The second is what we started discussing last afternoon,
John, I think
we have
a question.
A question
for this. So what
types of
information structures can you handle
with this? That's a very good question. And, very quickly, if you go try to understand the information structure versus the benefits, you get back to Wizard House's problem, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not claiming I'm solving this problem. But you can actually get interesting trade-offs. For instance, you can analyze routing under energy constraints. And you get very nice results for that. The importance of cooperative games is you have many solutions notions, like you have sapling value, and there are analogs of that in this constraint coalition. You can have nucleolus, you can have core, and all that stuff. why I like cooperative networks is cooperative games is because every solution has a different interpretation. So if you want to understand coalition of companies or coalition of networks, when you have a very good network and a small little ones, say you have the IBM on networks and the small companies, you can actually choose a solution that reflects this part. And by choosing a solution, I mean a notion of solution and an algorithm for convergence, which can be considered as a negotiating strategy. So for instance, we can use this theory to analyze how you make security coalitions, right? Where you have some less secure networks and more secure networks, and you want to put them together in a way that there's no incentive for them to split. Okay, so you can analyze this way. Yeah.
So now one of the problems that is really difficult in formulating game problems is the question of what is the strategy space you allow in order to then follow.
Suffice to say that here, the surprising fact here, and also in work in biology that's done by Martin Novak at Harvard, very simple benefits and costs, they lead you to things like, you know, supply value, which is a very simple strategy with these constraints. Constraints, supply value, and other things that you can compute. And you can interpret very difficult results in biology by this simple model. For instance, he has been able to recover Darwinian theory, which is based on competitive games, by collaborative games. We have been able to do very interesting things in trust.
I guess my question is slightly before that. When you define the strategy space, what do you decide what the user's choices of strategy are? Right? I mean,
these games you play based on local information, right? And the strategy is the one that maximizes the difference between benefits versus cost.
Yes.
So it's an optimization problem. I don't restrain any other way.
Yes, but actually, may I have a second question, because Shapley and familiar with Shapley value, but then eventually Shapley value you will compute all the possible combination of possible coalitions. So indeed it can be an exploding complexity depending on how many number of users, unless you create some hierarchies.
Yeah, the way I think we handle this problem is we put constraints on what information you can use in terms of your neighborhood or not. And supply value is not always the best one because it gives equal sort of things for everybody.
Yeah, but then to consider all the possibilities, all the possible combinations, to compute the supply value.
Yeah, we are much more interested at this point to understand connectivity issues, if the network can actually come together. For instance, if you apply this to security, we're interested to know if you can induce the majority of the nodes to cooperate in the protocol or not cooperate, versus trying to find the exact strategy at this point.
More like a fairness
method. Yes, that's it. So you don't want people to hog other people's power.
Yeah.
Now, this is not exactly the supply value you know, because there are two costs. The one is positive and the other is negative.
Yeah.
So it is a gain,
yeah,
which is not in the traditional sense that you have supply value.
Yeah.
So you have to watch this.
Okay,
so here's the deal here.
The
strategy we use is the following for these results. I show you the graph, right? You play an iterative game on the graph. You choose two pairs randomly. They decide to establish a node or not, depending if both of them benefit. They establish to cut a node if either of them loses benefit. And because this does not always converge, you have to introduce some randomization. So with probability epsilon, you do what the strategy says, and with probability epsilon, you don't. Then you can prove you have actually converged to a Nash equilibrium, and you can get out of this Nash equilibrium the phase transition I showed you. So that is that simple. And that's why it's connected to the random percolation theory.
It's like a safe experimentation process.
Right. So there is a paper on that, and you can look at it in detail. But that's basically the gist of the study. It's very simple. I look if I want to establish a link with him. I look how much I'm going to gain, how much I have to pay, and I establish with probability 1 minus epsilon. Epsilon, I don't establish it. And this is played throughout the graph, and you iterate it, and then improve convergence.
I know some results on this topic for quite some time from Jeff Sharma, who used to be a UCLA.
Not this.
Not really this. But
not this. Not in our community, I claim that we were the first to introduce it. If you tell me that the people at Caltech in economics have done this, yes. Johnson and Company, right? That's where I learned some stuff after we found out this for trust. Okay. The economics people, they have a lot of that, and they also do learning. But unfortunately, many of the problems there are stuck. I got to go on because I have a lot to say. So the next topic is I want to start to see the size network specifications, right? And this is going on from what we were doing for military, where you wanted to have networks that are adapted to missions. And now it's becoming more apparent if you want to have a clean slate approach to everything in wireless. So I view networks as basically the gigantic software systems. If you admit you have software radios, then the whole damn thing, the whole stack, all the algorithms become a very gigantic software program. And the problem is that currently these programs are written in a monolithic way. So you try to change something, you have to change a lot of things. So we went back to 0-1 and said, okay, componentize it. Try to do what people do in component-based software. Can you do it? Can you break? Forget the protocols you have, forget the layers. Break even the each layer to components based on the functionality of this component. And can you then actually do plug-and-play components to get different performance? Because one of the problems we found is if we try to discriminate, say, routing protocols, as a routing protocol as a whole, you cannot find instances where one is much better than the other because some components are better for path discovery, others are better for network discovery, and so on and so forth. So here, it's a very interesting system engineering mathematical problem, how to do it. It goes down, actually, the holy grail of software engineering because you cannot link formal models to performance models yet for software engineering. So we established a pretty powerful group between us and Joseph Aikis at Grenoble, and now we're also going to be working with Seth Clark to go at it. And the difficulties of the performance I talk about. So in terms of components, you have modularity, implementation, cost reduction, usability, adaptability, and so on and so forth. That's why people went software in the end to do that. You also have interfaces, because you're going to tell me you're going to plug and play components. Suppose you break, say, AVB and DSR to the 500 components, right? Network discovery, path discovery, and so on and so forth. When you try to take one component from another and apply to the other, you can't, because the information about routes is stored in different places, right? I told you this example is different. So you must have an interface to immediately translate this information. That's not even good enough, and that means to do this, every protocol must have a network discovery component, which keeps this information and translates. But then you still need interfaces. The interface cannot be just ports on which you pass data. They must be intelligent enough to understand or even build an internal model of what's on the other side. So this gets into some of the stuff that Tom Casey has been actually we're working with him. We're working with the whole European group on this component-based software engineering for network-based systems. The other thing that this does is, what is the big dream here? I mean, I'm giving you a talk that has a lot of ideas for the future, not for things that we already know how to do, okay? That's not the case. But one idea is you want to validate protocols, right? So the idea that software engineering people were enamored for that is, I validate the components, then I have theorems that tell me if I have property A, like deadlock free, under which connection type I can by theorem have that correct by design and not have to do it again. That's what we're trying to get. In that way, we're quite advanced because of progress that has been made in network embedded systems in this area. On the performance, we don't have that. If you have performance curves for component A, component B, and so on and so forth, first of all, the metrics are not the same. And therefore, the components have different metrics than the overall metrics. And we don't have a compositionality theory for these kinds of metrics. I mean, I give you a simple question. You have protocol A and protocol B, or protocol component A, protocol component B. They're both stable. You compose them. Is the system going to be stable? Fundamental control theory tells you not so, but it may be difficult. If, on the other hand, you manage to formulate the whole question in notion of dissipativity, you get it. Because dissipative systems, when you compose them, are dissipative. So how you formulate this compositional question is a very open question. There is Leonard Tolle in Ed Hart who's working on this. And to give you how difficult the problem is, even if I have a line network, okay, where in every box I have a performance curve which is like fitted. Say you have one variable like throughput and another parameter, and you fit the simulation and you get a performance curve. Or you try to do what Rene Cruz was doing with the ATM networks. Try to put these boxes together and predict by calculus the performance is difficult. So you need something like network calculus and for the appropriate performance model to do that, we don't know, okay? And what I was asking yesterday in the discussion we had, you need to link that to the formal model. Okay. So this is very interesting stuff. The theory we're trying to develop are these components. Heterogeneous components and their compositionality. Toughest problem here is time. When you deal with networks, you have two notions of time, uniform sampling or synchrony, and event-driven events. When you have software that operates on different time frames to different time modes, it's very difficult to compose them in terms of time, right? Because they're not uniform. So you need different notions and different semantics. Constructivity theory. Constructivity means I want to have by construction, okay, linkages that by can prove theorems that if I put this and that in this kind of connection, these properties I get the property I want. Performance of components and their composition. And then, you know, we do a lot of performance optimization for performance.
But then you need correctness of timing analysis by design. And you need to be able to go back and forth. The performance models, the timing. So the formal models, which are, say, finite state machines or finite state machines, give you this. The optimization, the queue theory, and all that stuff will give you this. So you need to go back and forth. Because when you finish by component, you want to understand his timing semantics and also his performance, and then be able to compose them in both domains, not in one only. That doesn't do anything. Okay, so the diagram I used to give is this. Executable model, formal model, performance model. This part, every arrow you see here is by simulation, not necessarily losses. It may be lossy by simulation, it may be stochastic by simulation. Executable models means literally executable model. In other words, I have a UML model, push the button, get Java code, get C code, get C++ code, I put in the nodes and it works. We have that in joint work with Tela, where Mustafa Bogacek, who actually was a graduate from here, okay, and he was a student of Ed Zonkin. Formal models is pretty well advanced, and we are working now to do the components of the formal models, primarily using communicating in EFSM. You don't need anything more, or FET and NET. The big question is here, and the limits to this. And we have some models, and you will see the detail of some examples of them. Now, in communication networks, again, this is another slide for whole new area. And again, you're trying to design network specifications. And we try to stay within a system engineering framework in the sense that you give you specifications which can be volumes of text. I want to translate those essentially to mathematics, which involve constraints and optimizations, and be able to do it. How do I do that? Okay, so. Yes?
Just want to clarify what.
Just be allowed when you need a question because sure. I don't look around all the time yet.
I just want to clarify the difference between formal models and executable models for you. Is it just high level code and low level code that works on the.
Sure. Like, so you can take a very simple example is I look at C code of the executable model, the finite state machine abstraction of that is in the formal model.
Okay. But then that should be a pretty straightforward compilation process.
Yes, the difficulty is building components. When the information you need to compose the components is not necessarily just data ports. Okay. This has actually been studied elsewhere, notably the fellow from BU for simulation. What's his name? Not the typical people that they work on. Similar. It will come to me right now. I have Pfizer and Alzheimer's disease, okay, so I'll get it. No, it will come at the end of the talk, I'm sure. So he was trying to do this for purposes of modular simulation, a modular thing, so that you can go clap together and you get an executable code in the simulation. Right. And there he ran into the same problem that the interface has to be much more clever. Okay. There's a whole group of people in software that they studied this problem under the rubric of model-based software integration. Okay, like Jan Stepanovic, your own Ed Lee, and Alberto, actually working with Alberto on that. Right. Alberto has worked on component-based sensor networks, which is a similar model because the components there are different parts of sensors in sort of as a whole sensor. Here we're doing a little bit more difficult because you're breaking protocols. These are much harder. Okay, so in terms of communication design, you're going to have these kind of properties. Everybody talks about it. The ARPA can define programs for that. Some of the key ideas is you want to have, we're getting to a lot of bandwidth that makes some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about possible. You have multiple networks, a node can be a Bluetooth, a Wi-Fi, a WiMAX. And there's a lot of bandwidth available depending on where I'm going to go and the requirements I have of where I'm going to go. I should be able, right, to connect any of these networks. We cannot do it right now because of the way industry works. You can have dynamic spectrum management and find your spectrum means and use it. You cannot do that very well now. And this is, requires feedback and probing. Another thing we're working to very much so with Hamid Zafakani down here from Irvine is trying to get his ideas and work on physical layer, MIMO, and directional antennas, and put them into the joint map-rooting problem to try to simplify, okay, which we do by optimization. But what it does is it restrains the set of solutions so you can actually don't run into this NP-hard problems. Now you may call this cheating, but I don't believe so. I think the solution is going to come by a combination of algorithms and network topology, network technology, insisting that I want to do it in one way only because the problems are NP-hard, and if I get good approximations, I get to be famous. I don't think it's going to give us real solutions. So forgive me for being so strong about it. The key problem to ask here is hierarchical adaptive mapping routing together. And we will do flow control later, as I was explaining yesterday. Now, how do we do that? And we do, in our framework, study robust material. Actually, we have a newly
from the army that were with several people from Illinois and Seattle and CMU. We're trying to put security of networks, not cryptography, and robustness of networks in the same framework. And we tried everything under sort of optimization, where optimization here for us means mixed numerical and logical variables. And we use some of the latest results in the unification that has happened in the last 5 years between logic programming, if you like, and constraint-based reasoning and traditional optimization, a la Cplex, for instance. Okay. And by the way, there are industrial products that they do that, like ELOG's products on the solver and the Cplex, so you can actually go back and forth with constraint-based reasoning. And what matters behind it is a simple idea. If I take a prolonged program and replace the logical variable with 0-1 variables, relax the corresponding program. Sometimes I get lightly to go to the structure, and the relaxed program problem gives me actually the solution. Bingo, and I have a nice solution. Doesn't happen all the time, but it gives you good heuristics. This is from DARPA, it's from Chris Simon, actually, in the one program, right? What they're trying to do is with this clever radio, try to have many networks that the network can, that the node can be part of. And you, the clever network protocol designer, you must give enough adaptive protocols to be able to do that in a way that's transparent to the user. Okay, so we're trying to get to that. What do we use is components, again, which I call a more sophisticated version of cross-rail. Because this says forget the layers you have and try to link them this way, break them to pieces, and try to make a much more interesting puzzle with more holes to fit. We do really try to treat this as a distributed feedback control board with asynchrony and all the things. The thing that makes it doable is that the feedbacks are local. You get very few global feedbacks. And you can actually, if you use some theory from Hadron Automata, you can make progress here. You can understand embedded behavior. By what I mean by that is you can understand how simple rules that you do give you certain global progress. And I think this is very interesting for autonomous networks. Very interesting ideas here from biology and others. This is the hard part. Performance models and Duke sensitivity computations. I'll tell you how we do it in one example. I consider these three components what I would like to define as QoS, you know, driven design. You put various QoS metrics and you try to put that down and then you try to execute optimization. The framework we're doing is this diagram, okay, which goes back all the way to the thesis of Miyang Liu, who's here. Alright? So what we did with Minyang is we did the blue boxes, okay, by using essentially approximate models, reduced loss models for fairly complex networks. One of the examples of the thesis is a very complex ATM network where we use actually the AT&T hierarchical routing, very complex algorithm. And we do it in the following way. You compute performance models, which can be, you know, rate type models, or any other thing, or curve. This is an approximation to whatever happens in the network. You can compute it by simulation or analytical. The difficulty is that in many situations that we describe, you don't have exact models. You have implicit equations. You have some equations, and then you iterate, and if you can prove you have a fixed point or several fixed points, now you have a model, but it's hidden in these implicit equations. How do you obtain sensitivities? Automatic differentiation comes to the rescue. You could design exactly for this kind of problems. You use automatic differentiation, we use sensitivities, and go back to the computer. The dream here is we have a couple of papers already trying to extend that to wires. This is difficult because you don't have exact notions of capacity, the equations are much more complex, Mach is a big curve. And the green box says we even try to do that in components. And that's the software we have and we're developing. Okay.
Now.
Yeah? Yeah.
On your last bullet point, something that maybe slightly ignorant. What does semi-rings have to do with sensitivity?
Oh. You're not a software engineer. All right. Semi-rings is the basis for logic-based reasoning and constraint-based programming.
Okay.
That's the mathematics behind it. Okay. And why this is important here is because anytime you can do like shortest path problems or anything that's a dynamic programming over finite sets, this can be formulated as a semi-ring problem. You can extend the semi-rings. Look at the paper of Verdoux and Poor of about 20 years ago. And then if you get the appropriate algebra, right, you can actually do dynamic programming over these structures. So this actually indeed provides a unification mathematically. So what's the difficulty here? You have to produce things like network calculus where the semi-ring is not a Marx class, but something else. And sometimes you can't, because these seemingly simple operations may require a lot of time to compute. Okay? So we are actually working with Dr. Dragopoulos, and for the book we're writing for you, okay, to actually put some stuff into practice. We have one for class, and we're going to do others. whether you can do it actually-like, which was the IBM symbolic program, where you can start from a ring structure and build the matrices, polynomials, and so on and so forth, and do the full computation, it's a very interesting question, okay? Because you get into problems of undecidability depending on the complexity of the ring. These equations look linear in the new arithmetic structure, but this is deceiving because this so-called product and sum operations, they mean more solutions than I'm programming, for instance. So are difficult matching problems that they be very difficult themselves. So you have to be careful. They involve cycles or monotone maps and all that stuff. You don't want to have it, but I don't want to go there. Another thing that has me excited is the connection to many of that stuff in social and cognitive networks. We treat social and cognitive networks of the type you see in eBay and DigIn and so on and so forth as a new kind of computing, because you basically have nodes, they interact with each other, there's a time-varying set of nodes, they can decide, they do things together, they do something interesting, they develop reputations for each other. So you can think of this as mathematically as a time-varying graph with weights on the links, and by links here I mean just the relationship between two nodes, not necessarily physically, and weights on the nodes. Okay? So now there's a generalized network theory that you can apply to this, which is built on the book of monotropic programming of Rockefeller, which is a forgotten jewel, right? And if you are brave enough to have extend this to semirings, you have the basis for doing a lot of interesting stuff, okay? Including things like, you know, trying to understand how trust propagates. How do you build recommender systems for these things, okay? And for us, for communication networks, trust is very important because you're not going to be in a network if you cannot establish trust for the answer to another node. It just won't let you in the cloud. Okay. Right. So that's important for communication, that's important for others. So with Tao Jiang, we did an extensive amount of work on trust, trust document distribution, trust evaluation metrics, how trust and distrust distributes, what controls the speed of convergence. And what we're working on right now, and what everybody wants, is high integrity reputation systems. Suppose I start spreading a rumor that me and you are bad girl, okay? How can you make it so that three of us do not do that so all of you can believe that, right? This has been done. Google has been reverse engineered. DigIn has been reverse engineered. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were stolen because of things like that. Because in a reputation system, we don't want to have a small number of players carefully placed in connection to change. How do we analyze these problems, okay? So, and this is not a game just in trust and networks. I think one of the things we have neglected, and I was raising some questions yesterday, is are there topology types that have good and bad properties, especially with respect to distributed algorithms in wireless autonomic networks? Okay. That's the question. And so in trust propagation, lo and behold, you get this type of iterations. The SI is the estimate of the trust of the nodes. So you have these nodes, they use some policy to decide in a communal sense who is trustworthy or not. So you establish logical neighborhoods. The logical neighborhood means I have some certificates on the guy or the girl, and I say whether he's good or bad. You don't need everybody to decide. Whoever is doing it. And the policy can be as simple as majority of the voters or more complicated. In the end, by the end, you're done, and the hats there are the confidence you have or the value that you have. You get this nominal iteration. If you use just majority rule, this iteration took exactly the same equations that control people have used for clocking. And then you can analyze it in a static network by Perron provenance. When we first found this result, we said, wow, this is surprising, right? It's wonderful. Not so. Because they are both consensus problems, right? So after we were very excited, we said, that, I mean, this should be obvious. And it wasn't the beginning. Now we're moving to more different things and analyze policies, not just necessarily majority rule. And you find very interesting phase transition phenomena here, which can tell you, right, the kinds of parameters you need to be careful. For instance, if you make it very tough for somebody to be declared trustworthy by having a very high threshold, the probability of paths, or the percentage of paths that they involve on, you know, trusted nodes, is small. And it can actually break if you make it too tough, which is intuitively clear. This is very interesting, it goes back to the coalition games, right? Arrow has a beautiful paper where he talks about trust as a lubricant for collaboration. You can change the word, trust to energy or to other things, and you can understand how this trade-off is very important. We have a first result in this, where we look at collaboration on the upper part, where the only thing you try to do is like team theory. You try to maximize the gain in the collaboration game. The lower part is a different dynamic, which is like a filter. And surprisingly, now people in these reputation systems started using ideas from filtering, from control and estimation. We still the filtering algorithms, we try to estimate, right, the reputation. This goes on because you can estimate reputation on the basis of references or by observing direct actions. Okay? If Gustavo does three bad things to me, I put him on the black book, right? Now it has to have some recovery to recover. Okay? At the same time, you give me a good reputation, I put it together. Okay? These are the kind of dynamics we're talking about. And what we proved here is that forgiveness period, then you can actually convert in this interplay between reputation based on action and the game, the daily game you play. Very simple result, there's a lot more to be done. We're just scratching the surface here. You get these sort of pairwise iterative games, and we have very interesting results with George Drakopoulos, where very simple ideas like fictitious play and other things give you very interesting insight about how you organize the system. Because, you know, in this world of networks and collaboration, you don't know where the other guys are. You know who you are, but you do not know. And sometimes they're very interesting. This is where the same rings come here. We look at trust as a way to compute a long path, right? So one computation, which is the product, is I go down a path, and I sort of multiply in this nonlinear sense the trust. It goes down as I go to more paths. If you admit that these paths are transitivity, if I have more paths to evaluate it, I get more. So you go into ordered semirings. Right? And there you can do a lot of things. That was the paper we did for analyzing PGP. But the beauty is that this is an old subject in trying to understand path problems and semirings. Right? There are several known tutorials, and we have improved on them in terms of their theory, for general path problems, for general such like this in networks. And that's what's going to be in your monograph. So that's interesting. They connect to, many of these ideas connect to mathematical physics, from the part of spin classes and statistical physics. And many other things, all right? So, I'm out of time. So, let me flash through some slides. First example is, how do I do the first diagram, where I actually do loss models for wires, right? So I'm gonna flash some equations. The notion is that I'm not trying to make you understand the equations, trying to tell you that I have a framework, right? So here is the recipe. You take Mac, and you go through the papers of Bianchi and so on and so forth, and extensions, and we have extended it to go away from the problems that Costas was talking about yesterday, away from saturation, allow hidden modes, all that stuff, right? Anything you want to do. And you build, I'm not going to say an accurate model, but a reasonable model of the various parameters you want to introduce, okay? Scheduling percentages, time, and all that stuff. You write down the equations in a reasonable form. This is the set of equations. And you do this for all the nodes, and for all the interfering nodes in the network. And you can do this even assuming some losses, even assuming some nodes that you don't know. Whatever the situation is, just be brave, write the equations. Okay? So the equations get ugly. Right? So you get things like this, right? For the scheduling coefficients, which if you read the paper that we just had in YOP 2008, it all makes sense, and the parameters you can argue, but you know they are very reasonable for assumptions as far as what percentage of time I can transmit, how what percentage of probabilities I do, and so on and so forth. The key idea is not that. The key idea is put it all in the soup, integrate iterate over the entire graph, try to prove there is a unique or non-unique fixed point. This is not a new idea. We've used it in Median 2004. The glasses meter I used before that for fixed networks. There are people in wireless by Atman, okay, and Hira. We just improved on that. Okay, you get a better one, you plug it into our model, and you crank the machine and you put the value differentiation with that, and you see what you can do, for instance, for routing, right? So this is the only example we did. Let me go directly to that. I said I'll skip all that, I'll give the paper. But this is the methodology, right? I want to do joint MAC physical layer, MAC physical layer routing and scheduling, and the big problem is how do I model interference? Well, you're not going to get interference in that. Let's agree on that. You're not going to get physical layer exactly. So you're going to have some statistical model. Put into these equations. What are we trying to do? We are saying, simply, when I want to admit something to Zan, and five other people trying to admit to me, okay, I'm going to lose some of the rate. That's the fundamental model, the reduced loss model, the loss model. Right? Question is, what is the epsilon? How do you compute the epsilon, this epsilon, or whatever formula you use? So here, this fixed point gives you a consistent set of equations between rates and losses. That's the fixed point. Unfortunately, in these equations, one minute, you cannot always prove that you have a unique fixed point. you have to be careful. And so I need this equation to control which fixed point converts to get to the nice one. Okay? We don't have the answer here. But once you get a fixed point and you go into the automatic differentiation, you can compute sensitivities of throughput with respect to one of the parameters. Right?
So do you come up with these parameters that you showed, are they IID nature overall, all the components of the network, or they are strongly correlated?
You can assume they are correlated because we take, right?
They are correlated.
They're correlated by the way we take. There are some local assumptions of independence, right?
Okay.
But beyond that, because we run it over the entire network, they cover.
Okay, good.
And so we cover that. And that's why the results are good, actually.
So can you comment a little bit more about how you loosely model the statistics of the physical layer? So let me offer.
Let me tell you, okay, so in a neighborhood, I'm sorry to rush, but I have a 7 packet loss probability between two leads. In the same neighborhood, this can be different. So I can, even if we are hearing distance from each other, I have different loss from different, that's okay. Right? We assume that you've done this a priori and give me a huge matrix where for every neighborhood, I know at least packet loss probability between any 2 points. Right? So this is offline. We're not claiming yet we have done this online. Okay? Actually, what we thought in the beginning was that by taking the horizon sort, we'll be able to take this idea and do it online. We can, but there's another issue with online. It's not just that simple.
Because it's certainly true that in some cases, at least from a pure physical layer point of view, that you are much better off taking a reduced parametric view of something like interference and estimating it well than trying to estimate accurately the entire huge model.
That's what it does.
You can gain a lot of robustness.
That's what it does. It does locally reasonable approximations, but then it tries to extend the entire network by letting them play through the entire network.
Right, but the point I'm trying to make is that the online part is actually
the online. I want that. I'm not ready to discuss online.
Is where you can.
You are more powerful than me. I cannot do that yet. Okay.
Well,
this works well for dimensioning and offline design. Go ahead, Anna. You want?
I just wonder, like the probability of loss depends on the interference you have. How you change it depending on the actual.
Yeah. I can change it, you can put your own model, you can make it time varying, you run this over, you know, over data that we have. Suppose you have this per hour, and you want to get...
I wouldn't make it time varying, I would make it varying depending on the traffic, like the number of nodes that are actually transmitted.
This is in the equations. The equations link,
link
rates and number of nodes, losses, and so on and so forth. It's
okay.
A very detailed model, way beyond the reference I gave. Okay. I can, the paper is in the way of proceeding, but I can help you. Anyway, and then you do automatic differentiation, and this works very well. But let me use, so here you see, so the sparse calculation, yes. And you run off net, okay, and you get exactly on it. And you go to a more complicated network, where you do like probabilistic grouping, a la Gallagher, because we use this as a benchmark to try to see how well we do with these things. And you compare, you know, three strategies. You do one path, or you have three paths, and you do equal probability distribution of three paths, so you optimize here. And you can see how well you do in terms of in the performance. So this is a routine application. Okay, let me close on that. The amazing thing is look at time differences already. You can do the optimization all in sub-second, and you use hundreds of minutes if you do one of net run. There's future in this, I'm not sure. In CBN, I will skip it. You will have the whole talk. The key issue here, which is forgotten, and you have to be careful. When I want to understand throughput, right, what is the effect of the pathfinding component on throughput, not necessarily the same delay variable. So if you are familiar with system engineering, you have to introduce what's called derivative metrics, that they implement the overall metric and understand the sensitivity to do that. That's what we're doing. And we're actually creating a tool that will help the user to define this. Right? Because you need to evaluate the component metrics, the sensitivities of the component of the overall system metrics with the component metrics, and then you can do component selection. So this is important. Here's a nutshell how I think network design will propagate. Everything depends on networks. Wireless networks live and survive by how well you do network discovery. You do network discovery, then you find paths. No quality of service on the path, just paths. It's a connectivity question. Right? So you run k-shortest paths given the information from the network. Then you assign QoS on the paths. Then you do root selection. It's very important to have multiple paths in wireless for many reasons. I'm sorry for pontificating. Then you come to the real hard questions. Estimate the overhead. You need that if you want to do a normal job. And then you want to do the most difficult job. Do all of the above jointly with Mark, which we tried in the examples that we tried. Okay. And the 5 components we have crystallized in this group project with Udell and the Cordia is these 5 components. And what we have done, we've gone and tried this to OSR, DSR, and so on and so forth, and we modified OSR by actually changing the most important component, network discovery. Okay, so just a glimpse. We're building model chain models for network discovery because we're trying to understand what if you change the parameters? How many hellos you have to hear before you declare a node? How many hellos you have to miss before you say a node is missed? These are parameters you can design, and they control the probabilities of error. And then we try to propagate this all the way down the path. So if you have wrong neighborhoods, how are you going to be in the source path? And so on. That's surprising without that I'm showing you. Permitting this, because it's cute. We're trying to understand effects of topology on convergence, right? So there was this Fock theorem that small go graphs, they are sparse, okay? So if you want to stay in the same sparse of the class, the distributed arrows go faster if you have a small graph topology. Prove it. First, you have to define what a small go graph is, right? Does anybody know? Mathematical definition? So we found an obscure paper that does the following. I'll be brief. Okay, this is funny, but let me show you something. The importance of being well connected. Look at this graph. Right? There are yay, naysayer, and naysayers. This one. The same. So the guys in the middle are square root of n of the whole node. Okay? The rule is majority you vote. Okay? If the majority says yes, you vote yes. This is Pellerin's result. Okay? So he saw that in this network, if you have a square root of n of nodes well connected to n nodes, which are not very well connected, the bad guys can actually get everybody to say no. It's an abstraction of what reporters do to us, what you can do by reputation systems and so on. We're trying to analyze that in a positive sense, right, trying to establish this kind of hierarchy to prove convergence of algorithms, and we have done that. But the interesting thing is with the small words, we have the first one about the result that says if I take the phi model of Watts and Strogatz, where I basically take a grid on the circle with degree 4, introduce some shortcuts. The mathematics is the following. Embed the graph in the Markov chain. Interpret the shortcuts as transitions between far away states with small probability. Now then you have a perturbed Markov chain. Almost the same framework that you do in this stochastic approach to Hamiltonicity, if you are familiar with what's going on. Ask Venkat about that. You know? You use the static graph, you use the Frobenius theory to understand convergence, and you ask the question, can I optimize, right? Which one gives me the best second argument? So you do that by perturbation analysis. You parameterize the epsilon as k over n to the alpha, where n is the number of nodes. And you find out for what values of alpha by asymptotic expansion, you actually get small world graph, and you get it that for alpha, right, equals 2, you get sort of small world graph. So this is a concrete result that tells you if you analyze it this way, the mean field approximation gives you what people call small world graph, and indeed it speeds up algorithms. Okay? We have done the same for two grids, two-dimensional grids and three-dimensional grids. To do it for general graphs is difficult because we don't really understand what's a canonical model in a general graph, a small world graph. Although there is this cave model that biologists use. Okay? Basically, I communicate with my cave people first, I make a bubble, and then some cave peer person goes to another cave, and that becomes a ring of various parts with blobs around it, which is almost like this field model. But it's not really difficult to prove. But this is sort of another thing that I highly recommend that we work on because topology effects are important and we haven't studied them. I'm sorry for being long. It will be on the proceedings over there. Question, yeah.
So last student we talked about the things similar to Kleinberg's analysis for basically study of grids with additional small world edges.
Yeah, but I don't think he has down a very nice mathematical formulation of what is a small world graph. Right?
Because he has also had...
I've talked to Kleinberg all the time, yeah. And
so is it a different experience?
The surprise was that these obscure three papers, okay, very few people knew about them, so we really struggled to find them. And it's a very nice idea of randomizing the model, go to the Markov random field model, look at the mean field approximation, and you get back to the deterministic, you know, the expected path being of certain type and the degree being of certain kind. It's a very nice idea. But then you have a lot of powerful tools for Markov random field on lattices that you can actually use to prove. Drawback. Okay, this is static graph. Try to do that for the problem we are interested, time-varying topologies. You get products of matrices that are time-varying, forget theorem of convenience. The only thing you have is things like Kirchhoff coefficients and bounds of these products. and we can extremely hard prove results. Although from the control community they've made some progress and we are also trying to use that. So when you have time products of time value medicines, none of that is useful. We have to rethink from the beginning. So I don't want to give you the impression this is too big, right? It's just a very first small step to understand if there is a classification of topologies like totally random graphs are aerial grid, total grids and small ones in the middle. Can I understand the effects of these three types of topologies? And then you try to understand if I'm close to one or the others, what are the effects on the most important thing for us in networks, which is convergence, speed, or distributed algorithms. And to come back to your question, or to her question, the key to go in real time is really to understand that. How quickly is distributed algorithms converge? And we don't know in real time. In other words, if you understand that, everything else I've said, you can say nice work done, but it doesn't mean it's not usable the real time problem.
And from our perspective, how the real-time issue is how accurate you can be, given that you have only a finite
yeah,
number of
situations.
Yeah, and
I don't
really
agree with you.
Kind of
I don't really agree with you. It's much better to have a bound canopy model to cover several situations than insisting on getting accurate models because you're never going to know how accurate they are. And you're really looking for results that they give you bounds, not necessarily a curve, rather than a tube if you have. And that's all you're going to get in wireless.